talking today about Easter, one of the key, if not the key festival of the Christian religion, and yet one about which I suppose there is more debate than on any other issue. And what I want to do is to look first of all at its background, how it came to be what it is, and then to discuss some of the implications of that. So let's begin by just looking at how the date of Easter was established. Those of you who know the story of the, what do we call, Holy Week, that is to say, the week in Jesus' life, beginning with Palm Sunday, when he rode into Jerusalem, continuing through the week, and then what we call Maundy Thursday, the Thursday when Jesus held the what is known as the Last Supper with his disciples before he was arrested, tried, and then crucified on the Friday, followed by the account of his resurrection on the Sunday morning. Now, that week is always the same week as the Jewish Passover. And now, the Passover, or Pasach, as it's known in the Hebrew, is the most important event in the Jewish calendar because it commemorates the passing over of the angel of death when the Hebrew slaves were in Egypt at a time when God was going to exterminate the firstborn of every family except those who had put a mark of blood on the portal of their houses, namely the Jews, and that the angel of death would therefore pass over those houses. And that remains, because that is the beginning of the freedom of the Jews from slavery in Egypt. It was after that that Moses led them out across the Red Sea into, eventually, the Promised Land. So it counts in the Jewish calendar as a key one, and we know that if we read the account of that last week in Jesus' life, that he was holding the Passover meal with his disciples on that Thursday evening and gave it a different dimension. Now, that we come on to the interesting point, how is the date of the Passover established? Because that is going to determine the date of Easter Day. Now, I'm going to just give you the official announcement of this, and I've copied this from a statement, and I read it slowly, and then I'll probably read it again, so that you can take it in. You'll be well aware already that the day of Easter can vary enormously over a period of 4 or 5 weeks, which, for people who want to establish their holidays, it can be a little bit confusing. But here it is. Easter Day is the first Sunday after the 14th day of the Paschal moon. Right, you've got that. Easter Day is the first Sunday after the 14th day of the Paschal moon. Now, what is the Paschal moon? Well, the Paschal moon is the first moon whose 14th day comes on or after the vernal equinox, that is to say, March the 21st. So the Paschal moon is the first moon whose 14th day comes on or after March the 21st. And that means in practice, perhaps I should read that again, you might like to work this out for yourself, and then you'll be able to establish, if you know the times of the moon, you'll be able to work out Easter for the rest of your lives. I'm going to give you that again. Easter Day is the first Sunday after the 14th day of the Paschal, that's spelled S-P-A-S-C-H-A-L, the Paschal moon. And the Paschal moon is the first moon whose 14th day comes on or after the vernal equinox, i.e. March the 21st. Now, in practice, this means that Easter Day, the earliest it can be, is March the 22nd, and the latest it can be is April the 25th. Which means you can either have Easter Day in the middle of winter, or what seems like the middle of winter, or very much when spring has sprung. Now, all this was decided, it was a very famous council of the Christian Church, which decided an awful lot of things, including the statement of the Christian Creed, the Council of Nicaea in 325. So it's been established for a long time. I should point out that the Orthodox Church, that is to say the Eastern Orthodox Church, churches of Greece and Armenia and Russia and so on, have different times for this. They don't celebrate Easter at the same time that we do. I think there was a song, wasn't there, sung by some singer or other. Who was it that sang, "I'm dreaming of a fixed Easter"? Bing Crosby, that was, I think. And it would certainly be more helpful to us all, I think, if we could establish a definite date for the spring holiday. I think that would be very helpful. The government has done the same with Whitsuntide, so that the spring holiday, which has taken over from Whitsunday, is always the last Sunday or last Monday in the month of May. And I think it would be very helpful if we could say that Easter was celebrated always on the second or third Sunday in April. That, by the way. So there we've got it. That it depends historically on the date of the Passover, the Paschal moon. So that's the date of it. Now, what about the name for Easter? After all, the word itself doesn't have much connection with anything Christian, or indeed anything religious, nor does it. In fact, it comes from the Anglo-Saxon word Eastre, which is spelt E-A-S-T-R-E, which is the celebration of the vernal equinox. We now know this to be March the 21st, but in earlier datings had put it at March the 25th, a date I should come back to in a bit. So it's the celebration of the spring. It's the celebration of the return of life to the earth after the death of the winter. And its name is actually after the Teutonic goddess of dawn, whose name was Eostre. E-O-S-T-R-E, Eostre, the goddess of dawn. So you've got the symbolism of light, life returning, light, the dawn, the light of the day returning after the darkness of the night, the life of the spring, the new life coming into the earth which has seemed dead for months, now springing forth with the daffodils and the crocuses and the buds beginning to form on the trees and the lambs appearing on the hillsides and so on, new life emerging. And that, as a matter of fact, is still maintained if you belong to a high church in Christianity, that is to say the Roman Catholic or the High Church of England, in the symbolism of Easter week. In fact, during the whole of what is known as Passiontide, which is the 2 weeks prior to Easter Day, the crosses, the crucifixes, and the altar, and any other imagery in a church will be covered over. It will be covered with various purple cloths. And over in some churches, and in certainly in religious communities, on the Saturday, Holy Saturday, with everything covered up, they meet in the church in the evening of Holy Saturday and will continue a celebration into the early hours of Easter Day, when they will sing, when the cloths will be removed, and they will continue right through the night. And as the light comes in, I forget which point it is, but as the light begins to come in through the windows of the church, they will sing the Alleluia, Christ is risen. And having taken part in that, in such a service, actually in a place called Teze in France, I can assure you that the moment is one of real exhilaration. It's a glorious moment when you've been praying during the darkness. Gradually the darkness goes, and all the things that have been shrouding the objects in the church, the symbols, are removed, and then the light comes and you sing the Easter hymn. It is a very glorious moment. question that I've got to ask is whether it's true. And what we've got to do now is just look, first of all, at one or two, or at least one, of the accounts of Easter Day in the Gospels. Now, I'm going to read from Mark's Gospel. Now, I'm reading from that because of the four Gospels, Mark is certainly the earliest to have been compiled in its present form. It is one that is used by both Matthew and Luke almost in total. There are only a few verses of Mark which are not also found in Matthew and Luke, which raises some interesting questions for those who believe that each was inspired. It's obvious that Matthew and Luke were using Mark's Gospel, but it is the original one, and it's very interesting to know then what the original account of Jesus' resurrection concerned. What you will know of Jesus' resurrection, I'm sure, is that he was buried on the Good Friday in the tomb offered by Joseph of Arimathea, and that on the Sunday morning, a group of women went to anoint his body and found the tomb empty. And I'm going to read that account. This is the resurrection as we know it. And I'm reading from the Revised Standard Version. I don't know how often you read your Bibles. There are two things a Bible needs, I think. One, it's got to be as accurate a translation of the text, and there are hundreds of texts, hundreds of documents which underlie the New Testament. The idea that the New Testament sort of came out of the sky ready-made is a total absurdity. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of manuscripts of the New Testament that we can study, and no two of which are the same. That is the fact. No two manuscripts are the same. And it's a work of scholarship to work out which is the combination of manuscripts which is likely to be the most accurate. That is a work of scholarship of great skill, actually, and time-consuming, and of wisdom to compile that. So that's the first thing. And the reason why the Authorized Version was, in fact, revised was that is the Authorized Version used still in many churches, sometimes known as the King James Version. The reason why it was revised was that in the period following 1611, when that was published, many manuscripts were found which were much earlier in origin than the ones that were used by the translators of that 1611 version, which meant, if you follow this through, because they were earlier, they were less likely to have mistakes in them. Because when you're copying a thing out like that, you do make mistakes. That's another matter, and perhaps I shall do a lecture on that later on. It's a very interesting, but a very intellectually demanding area of study. And so the first thing you want is accuracy of translation. The second thing you want is is to keep the resonance. You see, the great thing about the Authorized Version is that it has a certain poetic quality, not just a certain, it has a really dramatic poetic quality. I have heard, and it's no exaggeration to say, that the poetry of the Authorized Version is equal to Shakespeare. It was at the time of Shakespeare, or just after his death, and at the time when the English language was at its most perfect, really. It was as flowery and as beautiful as could be, and had a poetic quality running through it. And so that you really, in a translation, got to try to have an accuracy of translation, using the most reliable texts, but also to retain, because after all the Bible is meant to be read in churches, to retain the rhythm, the resonance, the poetical value of the Authorized Version. And while a lot of modern versions are more accurate than the Authorized Version, many of them lose that poetic quality. Now, I think that is probably the case with one that I had a small part to play in, the New English Bible. It doesn't quite have that poetic quality. The version I'm using is an American version, which was published in 1952, and which, in my opinion, and I can only give you my opinion, I was at one time a student of both Hebrew and Greek, and the language that underlies both of them, Aramaic or Syriac, and therefore I've had some first-hand experience of looking at the original manuscripts. And in my opinion, the Revised Standard Version is the best that is available today. And if you'll find it in most any respectable bookshop. There are a lot of unrespectable ones, but if you're looking for a version of the Bible to keep by you, this is the one I recommend. All right, that's a rather long-winded diversion, but let's move on. I'm going to read. It's only 8 verses from Mark's Gospel. That's all he has to say about the resurrection. It's from Mark chapter 16, verses 1 to 8. And this is what it says. And I think the best thing is just to read it, so that in case you've never read it before, or you have read it in the past but have forgotten, or you read it regularly but you don't mind being reminded of it. And when the Sabbath was passed, that is the Saturday, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome bought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week they went to the tomb when the sun had risen. And they were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the door of the tomb?" And looking up, they saw that the stone was rolled back, for it was very large. And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, dressed in a white robe. And they were amazed. And he said to them, "Do not be amazed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he's going before you to Galilee. There you will see him as he told you." And they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had come upon them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Now there, the original gospel ends. There is no account in the earliest gospel of any resurrection appearance. Now you may say, well, what about verses 9 to 20 in Mark 16? Verses 9 to 20, you can take from me and from all other scholars of the New Testament, are a much, much later addition, added after the resurrection had become a central feature, the appearance of Jesus, that is, had become a central feature in Christian teaching, and really have nothing to do with the case at all. It includes this absurd, to my mind, passage about these Christians putting poisonous snakes on themselves. And there are sects, believe it or not, in the world today who follow that text, where it says that you can allow themselves to be bitten by poisonous snakes, deadly snakes, and they suffer no ill. And there are Christian communities in various parts, particularly in the United States, where this is practiced on a regular basis, on the basis of a text which was written probably hundreds of years after this, the original events that it is describing. So forget about Mark 16, verses 9 to 20, not in the original. So, what have we got? We've got in Mark 16, 1 to 8, a story of a young man dressed in white. And by the time you get Matthew's Gospel, that young man dressed in white has become an angel in bright robes. And by the time you get to Luke's Gospel, it's become two angels in bright robes. But Mark's Gospel simply says a young man dressed in white. So there's obviously a bit of mystery about it, but it is not the original account does not have the sort of stories that Matthew and Luke and John add. Matthew has the disciples meeting Jesus in Galilee and his commissioning them to go out into all the world to preach the gospel, ending with the verse, marvelous verse really, "Lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world," or, as one version has it, a lot of versions have it, "even until the consummation of the age." Luke's gospel includes a story of Jesus on the road to Bethany, and having dinner with the disciples who didn't recognize him at first, and then suddenly we read their eyes were opened. That's the road to Emmaus, I should say, not the road to Bethany. And John's gospel has also the story of the disciples, or Peter and Andrew and co, back fishing and Jesus walking by the lake, and they didn't recognize him at first and so on. Other stories, therefore, have been added later. What is, I think, crystal clear is that these other stories are a later accretion, not in the original gospel. They have every mark of mythology. And it is mythology I want to turn to now, because it is in its mythological origins that we see the start of this resurrection myth. Now, let's be quite clear. This is a resurrection myth. Now, I'm not just speaking as one who is alien to the church. I am speaking what is accepted by a very large number of scholars, leaders in thinking, devout men in their, and women in their own right. The Bishop of Durham described the belief in the physical resurrection of Jesus as, in his words, not mine, believing in, quote, conjuring tricks with bones. The idea that the body actually came back to life again is wrong. It is mistaking the myth for a historical fact. I should be arguing in the end how important myth is, more important than history. But let's just look now at the mythological background to this idea of a god who dies and then rises again. Now, there are a lot of examples that were around the Mediterranean at the time when Christianity was beginning to spread in that area. There is Adonis in Syria, a god who dies, is killed, and rises again. In Egypt, there is the god Osiris, the same sort of story. But perhaps the most important one, because this god was actually worshipped in Rome at the time when the early Christians were being established in Rome, and of course Rome did become inevitably the center for Christian activity. Attis, a Phrygian god, that's Phrygia, a Phrygian god, who was worshipped in Rome, who, it was believed, had died and had risen again on March the 25th, the date in which many early Christians believed Jesus was crucified, and which some Christians to this day still celebrate as that event. So, Attis, the god Attis, for hundreds of years before Jesus, before the Christian message came on the scene, had been worshipped, or at least, yes, worshipped is the word, as one who had been a god who had suffered death and had risen again from the dead. So you've got that image, the death and resurrection of a god, but it is celebrated at precisely the same time as the Christians, or many early Christians, celebrated the death, the crucifixion on the Friday, and the resurrection 2 days later on the Sunday of their god, namely Jesus. And of course, in those days, they didn't worry about where the moon was. This was going back earlier than the Council of Nicaea. We're talking about a fixed period for that. It is also, incidentally, the day in which many early communities, including the worshippers of Attis, believed that the earth was created, March the 25th. If you read in some old Bibles, you get that date given to you, Bishop Usher's dating of the events in the Bible. And when you come to on Genesis 1, alongside it will say 12 noon on March the 25th, 4000 BCE, or 4000 BC, it will say. And that is the date it all is believed to have begun. And so we've got then, very interesting this, that you see, in Rome, where Christianity was growing, there was a belief which had been accepted for centuries in a god who had the qualities of the divine father and the divine son, who was celebrated there. Now, you may say, well, surely Christianity is a different kettle of fish altogether. Well, is it? The point that those who have made deep study of this bring out is that, so far as all their festivals are concerned, the Christians decided on a definite policy that if they were going to persuade people and this is a quite sincere policy. Don't look upon this as deviousness. I'm not suggesting that the early Christians were devious. They found that these festivals were being observed by the people, and the people didn't want to give up these the various festivals, the winter festivals, the midsummer festivals, the Easter festival. And so they felt that the way to most facilitate the message that they brought about Jesus the Savior, the best way to facilitate that was to have their own festivals at the same time, in which they gave their festivals a particular stamp. Let me just read. I'm going to read you now. I'm turning to the greatest expert on mythology that the world has known, Fraser's, and I'm reading from Fraser's Golden Bough. He says this: the death of the Saviour was made to fall upon the very day on which, according to a widespread belief, the world had been created. But the resurrection of Attis, who combined in himself the characters of the Divine Father and the Divine Son, was officially celebrated at Rome on the same day. Now, he says, when we remember that the festival of St. George in April has replaced the ancient pagan festival of the Parilia, that the festival of St. John the Baptist in June has succeeded to a heathen midsummer festival of water, that the festival of the Assumption of the Virgin in August has ousted the festival of Diana the Huntress, that the Feast of All Souls in November is a continuation of an old heathen feast of the dead, and that the Nativity of Christ himself was assigned to the winter solstice in December, because that day was deemed the Nativity of the Sun, the shortest day it was believed to be, December the 25th, the day when the Sun was reborn. We can hardly be thought rash or unreasonable, he says, in conjecturing that the other cardinal festival of the Christian Church, the solemnization of Easter, may have been in like manner, and from like motives of edification, adapted to a similar celebration of the Phrygian god Attis at the vernal equinox. So the picture we've got then is that Christianity is growing in a world in which there were already very firmly established festivals. Somehow or other, they wished to make their entry into the thinking of the people who observed these festivals. And they realized that by trying to abolish these festivals, to tell them that if they became Christians, they could no longer have their midwinter festival or their midsummer festival or their spring festival. These would have to go if they're going to be followers of Jesus. Rather, and they realized very quickly that they were onto a loser with that. Their view was, and this may sound trivial, but as I say, it was done with the most sincere motives. If you can't beat them, join them. In other words, you're not going to be able to abolish these festivals, so let's give them a different slant. And that's what they did. So I'm saying this was, I think, a very sensible thing to do if you want to persuade people of something else. All right, you can imagine them saying, let's go along with this, and then that means we're not going to deter them from the people from our ideas. And then we can put the message of Jesus across within that kind of framework. And that was the original way in which Christianity spread. Not by stamping on everything that they found around them, which was, to their minds, pagan. The word pagan, incidentally, means of the earth, and that's another matter altogether. But not by stamping on these things, but by modifying them. It's a process of what we call syncretization, and in a moment I shall be comparing it with another religion. But just first of all, let's make this point clear, that although they were doing it with the best of intentions, the followers of Attis didn't take very kindly to this appropriation of their festival for a different purpose. And there were long and vituperative debates. We have an account, an anonymous account, in the 4th century of our era, of debates between followers of Christianity and followers of Attis, in which the followers of Attis made the, you would have said, I'm sure you'll agree, quite reasonable point, that since Attis had been worshipped for 500 years before Jesus came on the scene, they had a certain supremacy, a priority, if you like, in this matter. Well, these Christians of the 4th century were in no way abashed by that. And they came out with what I'm sure you'll agree is a remarkable way of getting round it, which was to say, well, of course, Satan has influenced our minds wherever we view history by making us think or remember things as having happened one before another, when in fact it was the other way round, that Jesus, they argued, was really prior to Attis, but it's just Satan that makes you think that it was 500 years earlier. Now, you may say, how could people do that? Well, it is amazing what some people can believe, or persuade themselves that they believe, which is manifestly irrational. I would say that the belief in a physical resurrection is one example, but a very simple example, and a matter that is still with us today, are those who state adamantly and emphatically that the biblical account of the creation of the world in 6 days is absolutely literally true. And what's more, a lot of Christians, and particularly again in the United States, say, if you don't believe this, then you're not a Christian at all. You may remember the film Inherit the Wind, in which a teacher in Tennessee was put on trial because he was teaching evolutionary theories, arguing that the world was made over millions, if not billions, of years, and that the whole process was very gradual rather than created in the moment. And one of the witnesses was asked, do you believe in the literal truth of the first chapter of Genesis? Yes, he replied. All right, he said, do you believe that the world, different things happened in these 6 days? Yes. And so he said, very well, how long was the first day? And, of course, the first day, according to Genesis, all was chaos, and the sun had not been made. He says, how do you judge a day? Well, it's the time it takes the earth to turn on its axis. But how long was the first day, he says, because the earth had not been made at that time. And he said, well, God would know, and that would be the end of it. Now, it is that kind of thinking which says the whole business is obviously manifestly irrational, which I think gives Christianity an appalling name. We are, after all, as Christians, anybody is called to love God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. And my feeling is that a person who says, that is obviously irrational, unreasonable, but I'm accepting it because that's part of my belief, is not loving God with all his mind. Because I think one factor in being a Christian, as I think it is in following philosophy as well, is that when you begin to talk, you put your mind or your brain in gear, and to switch it into neutral and to say, well, we can accept that time can be switched round because of the influence of Satan. That kind of argument really is not only not worthy of respect, it is worthy only of contempt. So let us put that aside and state that we return to this question of Easter and have a look at this, what this process of syncretization. Many people on this have seen the parallel between what happened when Christianity spread into the cultures, particularly around the Mediterranean, and Buddhism. There is an interesting parallel here in many ways. Buddha was brought up as a Hindu, which was the religion, of course, of that subcontinent. But he claimed he separated from the Hindus because he claimed to have special revelation beyond the Vedas, the Hindu sacred writings. Jesus came into disrepute with the Jews because he claimed special revelation beyond the scriptures, the Old Testament and other books, the Jewish scriptures. So both of them are seen as heterodox is the word. In other words, not orthodox in their teaching. Both had to leave the country of their origin. Buddhism, for various reasons, one, the fact that the Hindus saw them as heterodox, and two, the fact that life became very difficult for them later on when the Muslims invaded India. But they had to spread, and Buddhism now is found throughout Southeast Asia and beyond. And Christianity had to spread outside Israel, or Palestine as it was then, into the countries round about. Both, in the process of spreading out, modified the original message. The original message of Buddha is contained in the Dhammapada, the Pali canon, the original language, dialect that Buddha spoke. And as it spread into China, into Japan, into Mongolia, into Tibet, and so on, as it spread, it adopted some of the ideas of the country in which it spread. For example, in Tibetan Buddhism, Tibet had Lamaism. So the Dalai Lama, who is the head of Buddhism in Tibet, the Dalai Lama, that idea belongs to Tibet and not to any other form of Buddhism. Rather, as the Pope in Roman Catholicism, who replaced, of course, the Emperor of Rome in the estimation of the Christians, is a feature of Roman Catholicism, but not of any other branch of Christianity. So Buddhism modified, and one of the great debates in Buddhism, as I've said in my lecture on that, is between this Mahayana tradition, the greater, wider tradition, and the original teaching. Now, the same has happened in Christianity. And it is difficult to avoid the conclusion that all the what is known as the miraculous elements of Christianity were in fact accretions, additions, which they brought in over and above the original Christian message in order to gain converts. And that therefore, if you want to find the original Christian message, you have to go back to the original gospel, which unfortunately has been lost, because the original gospel is known as De Quella, Q, the source, which is the teachings of Jesus. We have parts of it scattered through the present gospels. Come back to that in a minute. Let me just read one more passage, one more paragraph, very short paragraph, from Fraser's Golden Bough. He's talking about Buddhism and Christianity. And he says this, both systems were in their origin essentially ethical reforms born of the generous ardor, the lofty aspirations, the tender compassion of their noble founders. Two of those, that is Buddha and Jesus, two of those beautiful spirits who appear at rare intervals on earth like beings come from a better world to support and guide our weak and erring nature. And both, he suggests, which is true, both preach a sort of moral virtue as a means of achieving the real supreme object of life, which is one's, I suppose, you could say, the salvation of the individual soul. Though it's rather interesting that whereas Buddha says the salvation is found by entering sunyata, the void, which really means annihilation, the Christian view became that you enjoy a blissful eternity. But both are concerned with this object in life. This, how do we find enlightenment, was how Buddha would have put it. How do we find salvation, is how the Christian would put it. And I think you could say that over the centuries, only a small number of followers of either Buddha or Jesus have come remotely near to the example that they set. I think it is the case that the world cannot live at the level of its great men. There you are. That the world is has to accept, on the whole, a lower level of experience and of life. That has happened with followers of Jesus. There have been one or two who have come, who have had signs of being like him, but not many, and the same with Buddha. And I think that's a matter for some debate and discussion. Now let's just come on to one or two other points that go with this. The question is whether this syncretization is justifiable. If it is the case, and I think it is the case, that the original Christians were teaching a particular way of life, compiled, as I've said in another lecture, from all kinds of sources, but in which they have brought together, and it's probably to be found in the Sermon on the Mount, and you might like to read that sermon through. It'll take you no more than a quarter of an hour to read it right through. Read it aloud. It's found in Matthew's Gospel, chapters 5 to 7. It is beautifully put together. It is obviously a compilation of Christian teaching, or perhaps of Jesus' teaching anyway. And it has been described as being a perfect account of the Zen experience, the experience of Satori, of enlightenment, and a life lived according to the way of Zen, in which you live intuitively and don't assert yourself unduly. But it's almost a Taoist description. I could feel that as a Taoist, I would have great empathy with the words of the Sermon on the Mount. That seems to be the original teaching, and the rest, all the so-called miraculous elements in Christianity, and that includes, as far as we are concerned here, the resurrection, is all later additions. With the aim of linking Christianity with other cultures. And owing a very large amount, actually, not to Jesus, but to St. Paul. And I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that St. Paul is really the founder of Christianity. And it is St. Paul. It was St. Paul, after all, said, if Jesus is not risen, then is our faith vain. And I suspect that even some of you who are listening to this lecture will say, well, if the resurrection is not true, what is the point of being a Christian? Well, that means that you don't understand the nature of myth, and in particular, the nature of the Semitic way of looking at things. Because the Semitic mind sees ideas in pictures, and it is seen as a picture. Now, the question to a Semite as to whether the picture is true would be treated with astonishment. The picture is meant to depict a truth. Let's give an example of what I mean by this. In the Old Testament, we read that the prophet Jeremiah walked around with a yoke, the sort of yoke you put on cattle, a yoke round his head. And he walked around Jerusalem with this yoke round his head. And when people asked him, why are you wearing the yoke round your head? He said, it's because this is the yoke that the God has brought upon his people because they are being disobedient to him. They're being recalcitrant. So he's put a yoke upon them as punishment for their misdeeds. Now, what his opponents did not do was to start to argue with him about this and argue whether it was the case that they had performed misdeeds, whether Jeremiah had got it right that God was angry. They didn't go into a great theological or sociological or moral debate with him. What they did was went up to him and broke the yoke and said, thus has God's yoke been taken away. And that is how the Semitic mind works. It works in pictures. After all, the Gospels are full of parables, which are pictures conveying a particular truth. The idea that the parable is literally true is absurd. This is a story. It's a story with a message. Like the story of the Good Samaritan or the Prodigal Son or whatever. You know, you must remember some of them from your school days or Sunday school days. So, we come back to this point about the myth. There is mythology written into Christianity. But, those who say, if it is a myth and not historically true, then my beliefs are vain or Christianity is proved to be wrong, don't understand the significance of myth. The myth is the most important thing of all. It's much, much more important than history. History can be discussed and debated, whether it was whether this happened or that happened. Was Richard III a great king, or was he the villain that Shakespeare portrayed? You can give you different views of history. And history is a human concoction. Myth is something that goes back into our primeval past. We use myths to sustain our values, to express our certainties, even to say how we originated. The myth, as long as you call Genesis chapter 1 the myth of creation, then I personally am perfectly happy to go along with it. The myth, the idea that gradually there was this development from the original chaos to the creation of Homo sapiens. But let's look upon it as a myth. There's a difference between a myth and a legend. There are legends, legends about the gods, for example, doing all sorts of strange things. Well, those are interesting stories, but legend is a different thing altogether. Everybody lives by myths. All of us live by myths. Without them, we'd have nothing to sustain us as we go along. So the fact that I'm suggesting that the resurrection is a myth means that I'm giving it its strength. I'm not running it down. I'm showing how important the resurrection is in for people in general. So you might say, all right, what then is this myth sustaining? Well, this is very straightforward. If it is a myth, a story made up to contain a vital truth, what is the vital truth that the myth of the resurrection is proclaiming? Well, the vital truth is very simple, that the fact that Jesus died does not mean that the message he taught, the message of goodwill, of loving one another, caring for one another, and so on, going out of your way to help one another, being prepared to sacrifice yourself for other people, the goodwill and empathy and understanding, that is not destroyed by the fact that he was killed. I'm sure some of his enemies at the time when they crucified him would have said, well, that's the end to all that sort of nonsense, the fact that people can be treated equally, the fact that those who are at the top should be seen as being at the bottom, and that the last should be first, the first last, Jesus had said, upsetting the social order. They might have thought, rubbing their hands as they put him in his grave, that's the end of that. What the resurrection is saying, and its strength is proved by the fact that the Christians began to preach it, despite the death of the founder of their religion. What the resurrection is saying is that no way is the message destroyed by the death of the one who gave the message. That message stands or falls eternally by its own self-justification. We know intuitively that benevolence is the right way to treat one another, benevolently. That the message that Jesus gave, the way of life he gave and practiced, is the supreme way. Now, that is the message of Easter. Not the fact that something suddenly happened in a tomb so that the grave rolled away and angels come along and Jesus suddenly appears. In his glory, that is to do with a particular way of looking at things, which I would have thought by the 21st century was no longer necessary. What the message of Easter is, that the Christian message is an eternal message, which must be proclaimed and can be proclaimed with confidence, with enthusiasm, despite all the evidence in the world which suggests that if things can go wrong, they will, and that it is the person who thinks of number one who seems to get on. But against that, this message, which has never died, this message says, no, there is a better way, which will give a fuller life, a more complete life, a life that is makes life richer for everybody. Now, of course, you may say, well, that's not distinctively Christian, and I would agree that this is not specifically Christian. All I'm saying at this point is that Christians join others in giving or expressing this vital truth and use the symbol of the resurrection in order to give it an extra bite, if you like. So if you do go to church this Easter, or any Easter, next Easter, whenever it comes, it's going to be, don't forget, depends on the moon, and saying Christ the Lord is risen today, bear in mind that what you're really saying is that the message of goodwill, of tolerance, of understanding, of a lack of bigotry, that is what you're proclaiming, that this way, which very often in the world around us seems to be pushed to one side, that nonetheless, this is ultimately the way that the whole world will find some raison d'etre, some reason for continuing to exist. That is the message of Easter, and I find that as positive a message as I could find anywhere else.